Coming up on Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway, Aaron Lazar talks about Some Enchanted Evening, the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein coming up at Carnegie Hall. Also, Michael and I discuss various things around the Broadway community and in the news. Please stay tuned.
Sunshine, sunshine, ooh la la, skies are blue, la la, in the bois. Who can wear a frown? You can wear a crown. Feel like yelling hurrah. Good luck, bad luck, say la vie. It's a gay la vie in the bois. Breezes hum a song, children hum along. La dee da dee da.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, October 7th, 2012. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast this morning we have Michael Portantier. Michael is a writer and a photographer. You can see his writing and his photography at BroadwayStars.com. You can see his photography at FollowSpotPhoto.com. You can also read Michael's work at the Sondheim Review. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Peter is away traveling this weekend, and we weren't able to coordinate our schedules, so he'll be back joining us next week. All righty. So this morning we have Aaron Lazar is going to join us. Aaron has appeared in 7 Broadway shows. Let me list them for you. A Little Night Music, Impressionism, A Tale of Two Cities. It was the revival of Les Miserables. Is that correct, Aaron? The revival?
That's correct.
And The Light in the Piazza, Oklahoma, Mamma Mia, and Phantom of the Opera. So good morning, Aaron. Thank you for getting up on a Sunday morning and joining us.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So coming up on October 12th at 8 p.m. over at that little Carnegie Hall, they have the Some Enchanted Evening, the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein, where Aaron is going to be performing with other wonderful voices such as Kelly O'Hara and the Essential Voices USA, Judith Klerman, and a bunch of others. So Aaron, tell us about the music of Rodgers and Hammerstein. Are you going to be able to sing with the Grand Orchestra?
Yeah, in fact, Judith Klerman, the Essential Voices, and my brother, Dr. Chad Lazar.
Oh.
He's in the chorus?
He's in the chorus, yeah.
Oh, how fantastic.
Wow, so the talent runs deep in the family, huh?
Yeah, my brother actually was sort of on a path to be pursue a career in the arts, and then I was on a path to medical school, and then I crossed over to the arts for graduate school at the Cincinnati Conservatory, and my brother was still an undergrad, and he came to visit me, and he made a decision very quickly that he had no interest in pursuing a career in the arts, which is no slight to CCM. It was more of a comment on how hard it was and how competitive it was. And you know, meanwhile, the kid went and became a dentist, which is not the easiest thing in the world to do.
Because medical school is not that hard and not competitive.
Right. I mean, he went to UPenn, and I mean, he's no slouch, but I just think his music for him is something that is more of, he's more of a singer-songwriter, and I think that's what he enjoys now. And he plays in a band, and he's played the Bitter End. He's done some cool stuff. But it's great. Any chance for my parents to get to to get to cavil over both of their boys is always fun. So we'll both be at Carnegie Hall together, which is really cool.
Has he been in the chorus for a while?
I think so. I'm embarrassed to say I've been blessed to perform at Carnegie Hall a couple times, and I'm blanking on whether my brother was in Judy's choir. I know he's been in Judy's choir, and I really feel like we've done something together. It might have been this Sondheim's birthday with the New York Pops, I cannot recall at this hour of the morning.
Okay,
if my brothers and sisters and I were performing at Carnegie Hall, I think my parents' heads would explode. So,
well, I think my parents they're still holding out hope that my brother and I will eventually hit the road together and become some version of the Everly Brothers. But
you could do the revival of Blood Brothers. You know,
we could do that. We could do that. Yeah, I think my parents have. You know, it's whenever business is slow, it always is my dad and my mom being like, I don't understand why you just don't hit the road with the Chad and just you guys just make music on the road, as if like it's just that easy, guys.
Oh, you know, it was the 90s, and my family was like, you should go be in that show Friends, you know, because it's that easy. It's just,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to make a phone call, Mom.
You know, I never thought of that.
That's great.
Aaron, is your parents in the arts? Are your parents in the arts?
No, not at all. My father and mother are in the construction business. Actually, my dad runs a construction company called Beacon Construction, with my mom down in South Jersey, specializing in dental and medical imaging facilities. There's a plug for Beacon Construction, I guess. But it comes from my grandfather ran a construction company, my dad's dad. And so we all grew up in the construction business. And I don't really have, there's been no professional artists in my family. There've been, people that have done community theater, and my great grandparents always performed in their senior community talent shows. And I think that's where I was first exposed to performing, was watching like my great grandparents in tuxedo and ball gown singing Mammy, for a bunch of seniors in the building that they lived in outside of Philadelphia. And I was, you know, 5, 6 years old, and I just thought it was the most glamorous thing in the world. But yeah, I don't, I'm the trailblazer.
How did you get from South Jersey to CCM?
I went to Duke University to be a doctor, and then I took the MCAT and decided I was going to take some time off because they're good for 3 years, and I was pretty burnt out academically. And I'd done some performing at Duke, and a professor saw me doing a voice recital. I was a music major, and he cast me as Billy Bigelow in a big production of Carousel they were doing. And after that, he said, you should try and see if this is something you would want to do for a living. And so I got a $30 a week internship at Main State Music Theater in the ensemble and cleaning up equity housing.
Mm-hmm.
And was able to sort of see if I stacked up at all to New York talent. And I thought I did enough that I could give it a shot if I actually got some training. So I applied to the only graduate school program in the country at the time for musical theater, which was Cincinnati Conservatory. I don't even think the graduate program there doesn't exist anymore. But it was a blessing for me. They took two students from around the world. It was me and a guy named Joe Levesque from Canada, and we were the graduate class of that year. And then the program sort of dissipated. Oh, I think 2 or 3 years later. But at Cincinnati Conservatory, I had 2 years there and then 1 year to move to New York and see if I could make some money in the arts. And I did, and I got back from the tour of the Scarlet Pimpernel right when the MCATs expired, and I basically said, all right, I either go take the MCATs again, which I really don't want to do, or I take this as a sign that I'm going to work in this business, and I just keep plugging away, and that's where we are.
Well, I mean, Duke has turned out a handful of Broadway performers. Did you work with any of them?
Duke has turned out, is that what you said? Duke has turned
yes.
out a handful of Broadway. I am probably going to get this wrong, but I don't think I have. I mean, I studied with Manny Eisenberg.
Yeah.
And I know there's Kerry O'Malley, right?
Kerry O'Malley, yeah.
And Heidi Blickenstaff.
Yeah.
And Kevin, he's great. I'm a big fan of his, and I'm blanking on his last name. But I haven't worked with any of them. I know Heidi. I think I've met Kerry, but I, other than those folks, am I missing anyone?
No, those are the ones that I'm thinking of. Pretty much there. So you ended up over at CCM, and it's a shame we don't have Peter on this morning. Peter's traveling and couldn't be with us this morning, but we'll have to get the two of you back together to tell us some good CCM stories.
Yeah, I would love that. Peter was sort of, as the students there, he was our first introduction to sort of the the journalistic perspective on show business and the business of show business. You know, it was Peter and Jim Wilhelm from DGRW who would come down and talk to us, and Peter was just such an amazing influence on everybody because he's just the most positive guy. And he would review our productions, which were, you know, and to this day, I mean, to this day, I would say that the Broadway caliber productions, that school just does such an amazing job of giving kids an experience that is it's just such high quality. You know, we did Cyrano with the original Broadway costumes. It was unbelievable. And Peter reviews the shows and mentions everyone in the cast somehow in a positive light, you know. Even if you're, you know, pushing a cart on stage, he'll talk about you. So it's a great, it doesn't prepare you for Ben Brantley, but it gives you something to, you know, really feel good about yourself when you're at a really impressionable age as a performer.
You weren't around for the Frank Rich days. Nothing prepares you for Frank Rich.
I wouldn't know.
Brantley's a walk in the park,
really,
if you will. We got off of the topic of the concert, but let's talk a little bit more about the concert. Is this something you're in rehearsal for already, or is it something you've been working on for a long time? Or,
you know, you don't really rehearse for these big, glamorous Pops concerts, which is shocking. I mean, you kind of do. We've gotten together with Stephen Reinecke, who I adore, and we've run through the score for the evening at the piano, and we'll do that. Well, no, I guess next week we have an orchestra rehearsal or two, and then we just do it. So, in some cases, that's terrifying. If it's a show that is music that, you know, I'm not familiar with, but in other cases, it's great because you get to save a little bit of voice and you're not blowing out your pipes before, you know, the show.
Aaron, it seems to me that that you're actually billed above Kelly and Paolo, so I'm assuming maybe you're doing quite a bit.
Oh, well, no, I think it's because I have 9 Tony nominations, and I think Kelly and Paolo only have a couple between them, and, you know, Paolo, he'll win one eventually, but, yeah, no, I have no idea why I'm being billed, but it's probably just alphabetical.
I think it's alphabetical, I'm looking at it, yeah.
That didn't occur to me, thank you.
So, what else is going on?
Yeah, maybe you could tell us some of the program without giving away too much.
No, I mean, there's nothing to even if I were to tell you the whole program, it's not going to take away from the excitement of the evening. I mean, the program is just, Stephen likes to call it just a glorious night of music. It's timeless, obviously, and Rodgers and Hammerstein are certainly at the core of many of our sort of love for this genre of the American musical theater, and it's just a night of all their great stuff. I think it's music from 5 of their biggest shows: South Pacific, King and I, Carousel, Sound of Music, and what am I missing?
Oklahoma.
And so you're gonna hear some of the great songs from those shows. I get to sing If I Loved You and Younger Than Springtime, and We Kiss in a Shadow with Kelly, and people will say we're in love with Kelly.
Wow.
I don't get to do any duets with Paolo, but there's really no, maybe you guys can correct me on this, but I don't, and Peter certainly would be able to correct me on this, but are there any famous duets for men?
Well, there's
other
that,
than, like, Poor Judd is Dead.
Yeah, there's that part in South Pacific at the end where Cable sings Carefully Taught, and then it sort of goes into This Nearly Was Mine, but it's not really a duet. But that,
right.
Yeah, that would have been a possibility.
Yeah, I loved doing it. I got to do South Pacific at the Hollywood Bowl with Brian Stokes Mitchell and Reba, and that was a great experience. And any of my experiences with this music, I did Billy Bigelow with the Boston Pops and Keith Lockhart, and
wow,
you know, just I couldn't be more fond of R&H.
Can you talk a little bit about Impressionism? We didn't see it for very long on Broadway, and so any backstories that really didn't get out there that you'd love to talk about?
Did you see it? Did you get to see it?
I didn't see it.
I saw it, yeah.
Yeah, not many people did. But Michael, you did?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, it was supposed to run for longer than it did. I think it's just I think every once in a while a script comes along that everybody reads and flips out over, and you know, everybody wants to be a part of it, and that was the case with Impressionism, so much so that I think the mistake was that no readings and workshops were done before mounting it directly on Broadway. Everybody believed so strongly that it was such a beautiful play that it didn't need any development, and so it took off, you know, really fast with really big people in it, and it wasn't ready, I guess, and it's a shame, because it was one of those experiences of reading something that everybody, I mean, most of the time, my agents will, you know, send me an audition, and you'll read the script, and I'll know within the first 15 pages whether this is something I'm interested in or not, and usually, you know, if I follow the projects down the road that I ended up not being interested in, I feel like I made a good decision, and my gut was right. You know, either the project never pans out, or the project has real problems, or whatever. I've been pretty on with my own track record with that. And Impressionism was everybody's, like, you know, oh my God, like, this is a great American play, and for some reason it just didn't pan out, and I don't think anybody knows why, and I just attribute it to, you know, I guess you got to develop stuff nowadays, unless you're talking about reviving a classic that's been done, like Death of a Salesman, you know?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that'll never fly.
That revival, you guys see the recent revival?
Yeah.
Amazing.
My God, was that, I mean, it's why ridiculous. Don't they do that with musicals? why aren't you, I mean, I just thought it was so brilliant that the focus, Mike Nichols was able to just focus that on the words and the emotions of those actors right in front of you with almost no set, and, you know, it was just,
well,
it was so simply done with such simplicity that you can't help but focus on the words and the book.
Right.
And if you're going to take these great, you know, revivals, you guys, I just feel like you can do this with a musical and a revival.
But Aaron, don't you think that there's a vastly different audience that buys tickets for plays and musicals? I don't know if the musical audience is vast enough to support a program like that. I mean, we see it in encores where they can just really quickly focus on the material and not have to become all complicated with, you know, helicopters and turntables and chairs.
That's the theory, quote unquote, is that people want the trappings, all the elaborate sets and costumes and lighting, because they want to know that their money has been, you know, they want to see the money they spent for their ticket on stage. And I mean, there's something to be said for all of that stuff, but of course, as Aaron points out, that's not basically what it's all about.
I would love to see some sort of attempt at, I mean, I guess they tried with Little Night Music, you know, I mean, you did a Trevor's take was very Chekhovian and came from the Chocolate Factory. It's a smaller take on the show. I mean, I think it has to be the right show, because I think if anything failed about that production, just for me creatively, was just that it was too small because of the score.
Right.
And, you know, but if you find the right show, and I haven't seen any of John Doyle's productions, and maybe he does that. I don't know.
Yeah, I would say, you know, I mean, there's the additional gimmick or whatever word you want to use of the actors playing instruments. But aside from that, because they are smaller, you know, they do tend to focus in on, obviously, on the words and the music. And, you know, I mean, they're very controversial, but I certainly think that for me that his company and his Sweeney Todd, you know, I wouldn't want them to be, I wouldn't say they were the definitive productions, and I don't, and I certainly, I'm not saying that I don't want to hear those shows with full orchestras again. That's not what I'm saying. But as a, you know, as a revival, as an alternative, as a, you know, as a, another way to look at them, I think they were really quite successful. I hope you get to see one of his shows someday. I don't know if his Merrily We Roll Along is going to have a future life after it was Cincinnati, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about A Tale of Two Cities, which it seemingly is that Jill Santoriello's musical had been, you know, worked in and around the New York area for many years. How long were you with it? And tell us about your experience there.
I was only with it for the Broadway production. I know they had done something out of town, and I know it had been in development for many years. And my experience with it was in many ways fantastic. I mean, it was just a fantastic group of people. Got to work with one of my heroes in the business, Greg Edelman. And in many ways, it was just really disappointing for everybody. I mean, I think I don't know the ins and outs, you know, guys. I don't know what goes on the money end of things, but a lot of money was spent, and it didn't seem like, you know, they could float the show for long enough to build an audience because too much money was spent. And that's probably a grossly oversimplified version of what happened. But from an actor's perspective, you know, all you hear is, oh, you know, costumes cost X, Y, and Z, and this set piece cost this, Y, and Z, and this stunt cost blah, 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 blah. And it's really easy to sort of backseat drive and say, well, I would have, could have, should have. But, you know, who knows? At the end of the day, it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I guess if you're Annie, and you can spend $1 million a week because you're Annie. But if you're a new musical making its world premiere or whatever on Broadway, I don't see how you can spend a lot of money and build an audience. I don't know. I have an interest at some point in you know, I find the economics of the theater fascinating, and I guess that was started with studying with Manny Eisenberg, you know, back in college.
Yeah.
So at some point in what will hopefully be a long career for me, God be willing, I wouldn't be surprised if I take a crack at trying to produce something.
Hmm. Well, James, you're asking Aaron about all of the flops. They can be more interesting, and obviously
there's lessons to be learned. There's many lessons to be learned.
You know, I can ask you about Oklahoma and Mamma Mia and Phantom, and Les Mis, but I'm sure that, you know, lots of those things have been covered over and over in many different interviews. You don't really get...
Well, The Light in the Piazza is an interesting one because...
Yeah, I'd like to ask you about that. That must have been it.
Sure.
To do it.
I'd just like to know where Adam Gettle went, and please come back.
I was just reading about Adam Gettle. He's doing something.
I know that last night he was at an event that a friend of mine was catering at. So,
nice. I ran into him. You know, I run into him a couple times a year randomly, and I'm sure everybody anxiously awaits his next project.
You know, Aaron, did you get to see by any chance Broadway or Bust on PBS, the documentary about the Jimmy Awards?
No.
Because do you know what it is?
I don't.
It's High School Musical Theater Awards. They bring high school students from all over the country to compete on the stage of the Minskoff Theater, and then they choose one boy and one girl to win. And the boy who won sang Il Mondo Era Vuoto.
Yeah. God bless him. Yeah. I couldn't sing that in high school. cool. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, that was one of the amazing things because, you know, that his voice had matured to that point. Joshua Grosso was his name. And it was really quite, really quite something. Yeah.
Well, that's great.
So, Adam just became the our first artist in residence at Pace University. So, I think he's going to be doing some teaching or master classes at Pace and things like that, and keeps him in and around New York City and keep working. I mean, what's it like to be a college student walking in and Adam Gettle is your professor? That's awesome.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, when it's DCM, we had, I remember, a master class with Jason Robert Brown. And, you know, you never forget those things. So those kids are really lucky.
But you're right. You know, we would hope that he gets another show done before not too long. It's such a shame that the Princess Bride fell apart for whatever reason. And you know, I guess he, to begin with, he's it seems to be a very meticulous person, someone who really spends a lot of time on a project, perfecting it, and you know. Rather than someone who has a show every, you know, every other season, so that was a really sad loss that that didn't happen, and I'm not sure if I've even read that he's if there's anything else that he's got in the pipeline.
Have you ever done his Floyd Collins?
No,
that's I wish more people would do Floyd Collins.
So it's, beautiful!
It's such a stunning show.
Yeah.
So tell us more about Piazza, you know, going through the process of, we were just talking about, you know, for-profit theater and Tale of Two Cities and the other Broadway shows, but Piazza run through a non-for-profit organization happens a little bit differently.
Well, I joined the cast after they'd been open for a couple months and Matthew Morrison was leaving to do another project. And, I don't know, I had 12 days of rehearsal in the basement of Lincoln Center with Bart and Adam and Ted and some of the understudies in the cast, and you know, was thrown on, and that was my first lead role in a Broadway show, and it was closed 6 years ago, I think, and it was one of the greatest experiences on the stage I've ever had.
It must be wonderful to have the video, or do you enjoy watching yourself on video, or is it, you know, some people can't do it?
It's tough with theater because I need to do it so that I can learn, you know, but in the theater, how much are you going to learn? Because there's, you do something for 10 months, 8 times a week, and then it's filmed once, or maybe they filmed it twice and edited. No, this was live from Lincoln Center, so it was filmed once and it's on, and you watch it and just go, well, you know, there's so much about this that I love, and then there's so much about my work that had somebody just told me that I was doing this, or that I was doing this, I could have fine-tuned or tweaked it, and that's what you get to do on television that you don't get to do in the theater, and it's frustrating. I mean, I think it's an invaluable tool to be able to watch and learn, and there's so many union rules against it. It's you know, the system is what it is, but the filming of it and that experience at the time was obviously very exciting, and more people got to see the show that one night than were able to see it, I think, over the whole year. So television is obviously a powerful medium, and I think Bart did an amazing job transferring that to the screen, making it look beautiful. It was just before high definition television, though, so it's a bummer because, you know, if you watch it now, it's just grainy, and you just go, ah, come on, you know, it's high definition. But it was pretty special, you know.
One thing, very interesting thing about Piazza to me is the cast changes in it over the period of its, you know, entire development from the beginning. I mean, I know, for example, that originally Celia Keenan Bolger was Clara, and then it was Kelly. And Kelly had been playing a relatively minor role. And then the Fabrizios, it's just incredible. At one point or another, I don't even remember the exact order, but Wayne Wilcox at one point, Stephen Pasquale, and then then Matthew and David Burnham and you. It must be, people who are not in the theater, you know, maybe up for jobs and then not get them or be replaced, you know, or fired or whatever the word is. But it's not so public as it is in the theater. That must be really sometimes difficult to take. And of course, you know, I mean, every situation is different. Sometimes people leave because of conflicts and or whatever. But it must take a lot of grit to get through, you know, something like that, and never knowing if you're going to be the one who finally winds up doing it.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know what the perception of it is out there, because once you're in it and it's putting food on your table, I don't think that's much of a consideration. I mean, it's sort of, does the project speak to me, and does it move me on a soul level? Do I see myself growing and learning from this and being able to share what I do with people and get better at it and blah, 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 and have an experience, which Light in the Piazza provided, which almost no other show that I've been in has been able to match, which is really that Death of a Salesman ensemble feeling, where you are on stage with an intimate group of people who are utterly committed to living that story on stage 8 times a week. I mean, Michael Barres and I would speak to each other in Italian, and we neither of us are Italian. We would go to Joe Saravo, who's on Made in Jersey now, and he was the only real Italian member of our cast, and we'd ask him how to say stuff in Italian so that we could ad-lib in Italian on stage. I mean, it was just a rare, beautiful gift of a show. As far as the replacement stuff, I was at an audition for a movie the other day, and you could hear casting on the phone talking to someone else's agent saying, well, you know, they just made the offer to Colin Farrell and he doesn't want to do it, and I don't know why, I think the movie's great and whatever, and now they're on to the next star. Like, the way the business works that most people don't know is just that first choice is first choice, but there's second choice, third choice,
right?
And there's so much competition that if you're fifth choice, it doesn't mean you're necessarily any less desired than first choice. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
right.
It's just there's so many people making decisions, from producers and directors and creative people, and as to who wants who and why they want them and the whole thing, that, you know, the universe really has to come together, and when it's meant to be, it's meant to be. That's it.
And not only that, as you say, it's not only decisions that are made, but the way things play out. Aaron Sorkin recently told a story. I think it was in a, I think he was speaking at a graduation, and he told the story about how when they were doing A Few Good Men, they had this young actor whom he didn't name, who they cast in a very, very meaty supporting role. And then the guy left because he got a TV series. And so they went with their second choice, who was Noah Wiley. It is his very first thing, and then it turned out, you know, I mean, the TV series didn't happen, so the poor other guy didn't get the series, and apparently was, you know, didn't really have much of a career after that. So you just never know. The way you wound up doing the TV version of Piazza, you know, because Matthew had already left and couldn't come back, It's a combination of luck and talent and decisions, and just, it must be very, you know, it must keep your head reeling sometimes.
Yeah, the business is very difficult. That's the simplest way to put it. But I imagine many businesses have their own, you know, grass is always greener, so to speak, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like I said, it's just that I guess the main difference is it's not so public in other areas in most cases.
I see. Yeah.
So, Aaron, tell us before we wrap up, is there anything on the horizon for you that we should keep our eyes open for?
That's a good question. I shot a small role in Wolf of Wall Street and got to do another movie with Leonardo DiCaprio, which was really cool, and got to meet Martin Scorsese and hang out with those guys, and that was an incredible experience, having really only made one other big movie, which was J. Edgar. So who knows if I'll make the final cut of that, but that was just a fantastic experience. And then I'm working on a music project with a music producer, and we're trying to develop an album for me that's really been a long time in development, at least, you know, in my mind, ideas wise. And I've never really had a clear sort of understanding of what I want to do and how I want to do it, and we're getting really close to that, so I can't say more about that, but I'm excited to be developing that finally. And then I think that's what's going on right now.
Great. Well, yeah. As the music project develops, you know, and you're ready to share it with the world, I hope you come back and talk with Michael and Peter and myself.
Yeah, I would love that. Thanks, guys. I appreciate you having me on this morning.
Great. Well, you have a great Sunday, and we'll talk with you soon.
Yes, I'll see you in the concert.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Great.
Have a good one.
Sorry, that was my son's guitar. I'm going to pick that up now and let you guys go.
Sing another aria to pay for the guitar.
That's right.
Take care. Have a good one.
Bye, Aaron.
Thanks, gentlemen. Take care. Bye.
Well, it was great to have Aaron join us this morning. Before we run off for the day, we have a few things in the news that we're going to talk about. The Chaplin musical was a little article there in the New York Magazine, wasn't there, Michael?
Oh, yeah, it wasn't even an article. It was a little mention in their approval matrix, which I've mentioned before. They tend to have really interesting, funny, witty things on that page. And what it is they rank various things that happened in all walks of life on a grid. They have highbrow at the top and lowbrow at the bottom. And then on the left, they have despicable. And on the right, they have brilliant. And somewhere in the highbrow despicable area, but, you know, despicable, but closer to, you know, to the brilliant side of it, because it's not that despicable. They have a little thing that says, note to Broadway lyricist Christopher Curtis, Chaplin does not rhyme with happen. So I mentioned that because Peter and I had discussed the false rhymes in the show and how inappropriate they seemed, especially to that type of show. So that just made me chuckle. I'm sorry that I think there is so much that's good in Chaplin, including the performances of Rob McClure and Christiane Noll and Wayne Wilcox, who we mentioned previously, and Jim Borstelman, and a lot of the music, and also, well, just many. There are many things in it that are really wonderful. So I'm sorry that they. That the flaws seem to have doomed it in the eyes of, well, certainly many of the critics and maybe some of the audiences. It is hanging on. We haven't gotten a closing notice yet. I thought that we would have, not so much because of the lack of quality, but just because it's, you know, it doesn't have a major star in it. And there's a feeling that Charlie Chaplin, although he's a tremendously iconic figure in history, is maybe not that in the forefront of the minds of, you know, younger theater goers or even middle-aged theater goers at this point. So, it's interesting. I wonder how long it's going to be with us.
Well, last week we interviewed, Robert Cuccioli, and I think during the Robert Cuccioli interview, I said, well, you know, it looks like Rebecca's on.
Yeah. Well, that was changing hourly.
As we were talking with Robert Cuccioli last week, the Rebecca story was unfolding that it was, looks like it's not going to happen. Michael, you were walking by the theater earlier this week, and you really have, if there are any signs out there, well, tell us about what you saw.
Oh, it was so sad. I was walking through, I walked through the theater district on my way to work, and I didn't even quite realize what I was seeing at first, but I looked up and somebody was painting over the marquee of Rebecca with black paint, you know, one lone guy painting it over. And you don't really see that very much. And I just whipped out my cell phone and took a photo of it, because it just was so, I mean, it was really very sad. And if nothing else, it's certainly an indication that it's really not happening, you know, certainly not in the short term. I can't imagine that they would be able to get it together again. And by the way, somebody had asked me, would this be the first time in history that a marquee of a show has gone up twice and then the show's not open? And I think maybe it is. I mean, I can't speak to everything that happened in history, but I can't remember that ever happening before, because the marquee went up last spring and came down and then went up now, and now it's being painted over. And apparently, maybe you know more about it than I do, James, and it was explained to me that the reason it was painted over is because when they do it that way, they don't have to have a full union call, you know, to actually take down everything, which is, you know, it's much more expensive, obviously, to hire union people to do that. And somebody has to pay for that stuff to come down, whether it's the show that is closing, but usually I understand correctly, it's the show that's coming in. And since there's no show coming in, I guess they decided they would just paint it over. Another alternative would have been to just leave the marquee there, but I guess maybe they didn't want to confuse people.
Yeah, I guess if Rebecca's not going in, there's lots of people and shows that would like that theater. So yeah.
And this is still unfolding, as you say. And we want to be careful about saying too much in cases where, like, criminal investigation is underway, which is what's happening here. But it's hard to imagine how this happened. Some people say it happens more than we realize, in the sense that many shows do not have their capitalization complete by the time they go into rehearsal and or even start previews. It's hard to answer that definitively. If people say it's true, maybe it is. But aside from that, it's just the specifics of this situation where there was this major, major investor whom, by his own admission, the producer Ben Sprecher never actually spoke to or met, and his communication with him was limited to emails. So even if that is true and that person was not invented, as some people are suggesting or speculating, it just seems, you know, maybe an irresponsible way to try to capitalize a show and to get that far and have all of these people, you know, committed to it and assuming they're going to have a paycheck for at least a few weeks. I know a friend of mine told me that the composer flew in from Europe, I believe, like the day before it was finally announced that the show was not going to happen. And that's just really unfortunate. So I don't know what else to say, but I'll tell you, it's this is one of the biggest theater stories I can think of since I don't know what was the last one. You know, it's really getting major, major play in all media. So I guess we presumably will find out more.
Yeah, you know, I think that it is You're going to peel the covers back off of theater financing a little bit. And it's not so shocking to me that a Broadway producer had not met an investor because of, from what I'm reading in this story, the way this is coming together, is that many Broadway, quote unquote, producers, not the top line ones that you're going to see, that are the faces that accept Tony Awards, but other people that are listed further down the list of producers are really sort of more or less bundlers, people who will say, I'm going to be responsible for, you know, $250,000, $500,000 worth of investors, to get them together, get a bunch of smaller investors into one group and bring that group's money to the production, and then that quote-unquote producer is the person that's there. And I feel that's probably what happened with this, is that somebody had come to Mr. Spector and said that they have a $4.5 million investment, and that you just expect when they say those things that that, you know, you do have to do some due diligence. And it seemed like he was convinced that this was a real investment, and they kept moving forward. So, but nobody ever wants to see how they make the sausage, but this is how it's done. So we'll see as it unfolds. It's just a terribly sad story for so many people involved in this whole thing.
So many people: Jill Pace, the wonderful Jill Pace, Karen Mason, James Barber, you know, just.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know.
And those are just the marquee names.
Ben Spector, you know, or could be on the hook for millions of dollars here that needs to come out of his own pocket because somebody lied to him. So this is a very serious thing, and this could end Mr. Spector's career.
Spector, yeah. Yeah, because quite a bit of money had been spent already on sets and et cetera. So, and that can't be, that's just gone, you know.
In other things in the news, the Public Theater has got launched a $40 million renovation of its facilities, and that's very exciting. And they got to start off with $1 million donation, and that was quite the news this week. It was all over the place. Kander and Ebb's Steel Pier is going to be playing London for the first time. Michael, what do you think about that?
I didn't know about it until you mentioned it. I think it's great. Maybe I'll go to London. I really love that show overall, despite its flaws. That was another fascinating example of how you never know what's going to happen, because I think the buzz on that show was tremendous. And then it just opened, and at the same time, almost the same time as Titanic, I believe. And that was quite a situation, because the buzz on Titanic, as I recall, was quite negative. And I seem to remember Michael Riedel making tremendous amounts of fun of it before it even opened, among other people, and then sort of doing a turnaround. At least that's how I remember it. But but Steel Pier, apparently was one of those shows that just is incredibly wonderful in workshop. And then for whatever reason, when it got to the stage and the Broadway stage and it opened, it just a lot of people felt it didn't really work, despite the fact that it had a terrific Kander and Ebb score, really some wonderful, wonderful songs in that. I think that, and it was probably little things that snowballed. One thing is they couldn't seem to make a firm decision as to whether, how clear they wanted to make it, that the leading male character was a ghost. And so I believe the original plan was not to make it clear at the beginning of the show and have that fact sort of reveal itself as the show went along. And then they got nervous. They didn't know if people were getting it. So they sort of fudged it. And by the time I saw it, they wound up with an opening that sort of made it clear, but didn't 100% that he had died in a plane crash. So maybe that was a lot of it. There were some other things. As much as I love this score, there were a couple of songs I thought that didn't work. One of them called A Powerful Thing, which was a duet at the beginning between Gregory Harrison, who was sort of the villain of the piece, and Ron Carroll. And then there was a song called Running in Place in Act Two for Karen Ziemba that seemed like it was – that should not have been there. But incredible songs like Willing to Ride, Everybody Dance – Dance with Me, and the last girl, a beautiful, beautiful ballad that the late Daniel McDonald, sang so beautifully, and the choreography was incredible. For those of you who don't know the show, it was about the dance marathons of the 30s and how basically inhuman they were in many respects, and desperate people trying to win these marathons in order to get some money. So I'm glad to hear it's being done in London. Apparently, James, it's not a big West End production. It's more of an off-Broadway equivalent. But maybe a smaller production, you know, will work better.
Michael, did you mention that it was Kristen Chenoweth's Broadway debut?
No, I was about to. Yeah, that was another thing. It was her debut, and I think her part got cut significantly during the development of it because, again, they weren't quite sure, you know, where the focus should be and exactly how to tell the story. Yeah, but I'll never forget her in that. She had a big sort of operatic coloratura number in Act Two. That was her big shining moment.
Yeah, she's... hasn't done much since then, has she?
Yeah, whatever happened to her?
Yeah. It's a big, big cast. I'm looking at it here.
It is. That's another thing that...
Casey, you know, Nicola was in it. Oh, that's right. I forgot. Deborah Monk.
Yes.
Leanne Wechler.
Jim Karen Newman. Zaber. Jim Newman played Kristen's better half, and who was very frustrated with her because she was trying to... kind of grabbed the spotlight, I guess.
she had
ambitions.
Joanne Hunter. Oh God, what a huge, beautiful cast. I forgot about that.
But yeah, but the thing I remember most is how everyone. It seemed like everyone thought that Titanic was going to be this horrible, campy bomb, and Steel Pier was going to be the great show and the Tony Award winner, and it turned out that Titanic turned into quite the hit, and Steel Pier just unfortunately fell by the wayside.
Yeah, that's well, I'm glad to see this kind of have another opportunity, and who knows how these things go, but if it does really well in London, maybe some American producer will see it and discover it and bring it back to Broadway. This sometimes happens.
Yeah, so
Michael, you had a column this week on Broadway Stars called "Hello Gorgeous" with a big picture of Barbra Streisand, and then all you did was talk about Scott Nevins. Talk with Scott Nevins. So tell us about this interview you had with Scott.
Well, he's put together what sounds like it's going to be a really fun benefit for Broadway Cares called "Hello Gorgeous." And that is happening on the night between Barbara's two big concerts at the Barclays Center. That's this coming Friday, October 12th, which is also the same night as the New York Pops concert that Aaron Lazar is doing with Kelly O'Hara and Paola Schott. So a lot is happening on Friday the 12th, and a lot is happening this coming weekend. Hello Gorgeous is billed as a celebration of Barbra, but also more so the music that she made famous, the songs that are so closely associated with her. So you're going to hear, I'm sure, everything you'll expect to hear. And they have quite a great company set that he's gathered together, led by Lorna Luft and Anne Hampton Calloway, who has written for Barbra. Lots of other fun people, including Steven Brinberg, who has impersonated Barbra all over the world with in concerts with Marvin Hamlisch, who worked with Barbara very closely and was one of her best friends. So that's something to keep in mind on Friday night if you want to support Broadway Cares and see what sounds like it's going to be a really fun show.
All right, so let's wrap up here. What do you have coming up this week?
Well, I think I'm going to be at the Pops concert. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to miss Hello Gorgeous, but we can't do everything, can we? I'm seeing Grace, which I'm really looking forward to, with Paul Rudd and Michael Shannon, who got an incredible rave review from Ben Brantley in the Times. I haven't seen Michael Shannon on stage. I don't know if he's been on stage since I saw him in Bug years ago down at the Greenwich House, that theater. And he then wound up doing the film version of it too. And now he's quite a noted movie actor. So that's big news that both Michael Shannon and Paul Rudd are in this play. Really looking forward to that. Tomorrow night I have Bob Cuccioli, our pal, at Birdland. Then I'm going to see Otello at the Met on Saturday night. So, yeah, I have a lot coming up.
All right. So I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe button. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. If, in fact, you don't want to listen to us on iTunes, you can listen to us through the Stitcher app, which is an app for your smartphone or device, and you can automatically stream to it. You can also listen to us on Broadway World Radio, Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. If you do listen to us on iTunes, please leave us some positive feedback on iTunes, because positive feedback on iTunes will help us raise in the iTunes rankings and get us profiled in on the iTunes store, so that other lovers of Broadway will be able to find our broadcasts very easily. We need listener volunteers to help us out with a few projects. So if you have a few hours a week and you'd like to help out, please contact me at james@broadwayradio.com. And if you want to contact Michael or Peter or anything else, or see what else we have, go to our show page at broadwayradio.com, and all the notes from all the episodes and downloads from back episodes are all there, so that you can get caught up. We'll even post a picture of the Rebecca marquee being painted over, so you could see it for yourself. And we have links to all the other articles of things we talked about there as well this week. All right, so on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, who'll join us back next week, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broad Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Daybreak may break the spell.